we'll wait till, it'll be easier for you.
I agree. I have a lot of empathy for you having two ERISA cases in one morning.
What?
I have a lot of empathy for you having two ERISA cases in one morning.
Be still, my mouth.
Okay. So, case number 64350, Central Illinois Carpenters Health and Welfare versus Olson. Mr. Pollard.
May it please the court. My name is John Pollard, and I'm representing the appellants in this case, J&L Builders, J&L Construction, and J. Olson. I'm not going to discuss any of the facts. I'm sure you're familiar with them in the brief, so I'd be willing to answer any questions you may have about any of those facts. I really want to discuss two main things. That's the rulings by the district court in both granting the fund summary judgment and denying J&L summary judgment. Now, when the court granted the fund summary judgment, it relied on the auditor reports. And these were a series of reports that the funds had performed prior to filing the lawsuit to establish the amount, if any, of contributions that were owed by appellants. There are several deficiencies with these reports that made the district court's reliance on them improper. There are three reports in issue, and in all three of those reports, they contain several disclaimers. The first one is that the reports are based on agreed-upon procedures. And basically what that says is that the funds told the auditor to consider certain facts, consider certain assumptions, and then render a decision based on the information we supply you. In the beginning of those reports, there's a disclaimer that says, anybody who does not agree with the sufficiency of these procedures or has not agreed to apply these procedures cannot use these reports. Obviously, the district court had nothing to do with these procedures and did not agree to the sufficiency of those procedures. So it is our opinion that they cannot be relied on to establish any liability on the part of appellants because they were based on these agreed-upon procedures that were never agreed upon. Additionally, each one of the reports...
Were these calculations just an error? Or what,
pardon?
What procedures exactly?
Well, for example, one of the agreed-upon procedures was an assumption that for any work we cannot find evidence whether it was covered work or not, the assumption will be that it's covered work. That would be one of the procedures that was agreed upon. And that's another one of our complaints with the reports.
Look, I'm going to set forth my problem for you. We can affirm on any basis that we find in the record. So it really doesn't matter what the district court said here. To me, the biggest problem that you would have on appeal is you've agreed to the amount of damages, so the only issue is liability. And if the businesses are a single employer, then Olson should have been making contributions for all the hours worked, not just the hours worked on the commercial side. And it seems to me that the only distinction between these two businesses seems to be in his mind. What evidence supports the conclusion that there's not a single employer?
Well, there's a whole section in our brief which addresses that.
Well, I'm asking you to repeat
the argument. That's covered by the brief that I'd like to make, is let's go to the trust agreement because that's really what governs what's going on here. And there's no mention in the trust agreement about single employers. The trust agreement sets out the procedures that the funds had to use in order to establish liability. And it's our position that the single employer issue would merely establish here are the individuals or entities that could be liable. But first, you have to proceed under the trust agreement and what it requires to establish liability. And under the trust agreements, it states that upon the completion of an audit, the funds then can go forward, file a lawsuit, seek to collect damages. If there's a single employer, seek damages on those bases, collect audit costs, collect interest. But there has to be an audit to get to that threshold moment. There's nothing in the trust agreement that says if there's any determination of a single employer, then the case is over. And in this case...
Trust agreements don't say audit. They say audit of the payroll. So why would anyone think that requires a full-blown audit of an employer's financial statements? What sense would it make when the sole purpose of the audit is to determine if the employer has made the contributions that it owes based on the hours worked? Why would anyone have to review all the company's financial statements to find the answer to that question?
Well, actually,
I just can't get it.
Actually, the trust agreement does not say audit of payroll records. What it says, audit or other evidence.
They say, quote, audit of the payroll, unless I have really missed something.
Well, I can grab the it's in the supplemental appendix, and I could quote you the exact language.
Well, we'll look at it later because you don't really have a lot of time. But
well, I think that's a key point, though.
Well, maybe you know, Mr. Moody will help me.
What page? You know what page on your supplemental?
20. You're not using up time, don't worry.
That's all right. Okay, here's the actual language. It's in the supplemental brief on page 45. There's actually several pages because I quote from all three of them. But what it says that, in the event that upon an audit made by the trustees. So the question is, what does the word audit mean? It doesn't say in the case of an audit that contains certain contractual assumptions. It doesn't say in the case of an audit which uses agreed upon procedures. And one of our real problems with that is the district court never addressed this question.
Well, if you would turn to page 23, at the very bottom it says, quote, the trustees may have an audit made by an independent certified public accountant of the payroll. So it's an audit of the payroll. It's your brief.
I understand.
Yeah.
Well, even in that case, it still has to be an audit, I would say. It can't be something that contains contractual assumptions that aren't warranted by the trust agreement. It can't rely on agreed-upon procedures that the district court never agreed to.
Well, I guess the trouble I have is every audit has some assumptions. Every audit has some procedures. What's wrong with these?
Well, what's wrong with these is the issues I've raised and what the case law says. In any case where the trust relies on an audit report to establish contributions are owed, if the employer comes forth with any evidence which raises a question as those reports, then there's a question of fact that has to go to trial and cannot be granted summary judgment. We think there are several problems with these audits, audit reports, whatever word you want to use, and therefore there should have been a trial on this issue as to whether or not there was sufficient evidence as to the appellant's liability.
Well, there seems to be no distinction as far as the employees. I maybe can ask you this question. For instance, if an employee worked 40 hours for J&L Builders and another 10 hours for J&L Construction, I assume he'd be paid overtime, right?
I assume so, too.
Yeah, and so it's all cumulative. There's no distinction. And that's I guess, when we get to the bottom line, where's the distinction? If they're paid the same, then everything is assumed the same. And I guess you're pointing out, we say, yeah, but we had this internal agreement that somehow separated them so they don't have to pay into the fund.
I understand that, but my argument goes to that threshold issue of an audit, that under the trust agreement they could only file a lawsuit if they had done an audit and found that these contributions are owed. It doesn't say, you know, file a lawsuit, do your investigation, you find some evidence, then you can collect audit costs, you can collect attorney fees, you can collect prejudgment interest. It all, to me, comes down to what does that word audit mean? And the district court never addressed that issue, so we don't really know what the district court's belief. It made no findings on that issue. When we had filed our initial motion for summary judgment, which was denied, the district court indicated it might have to revisit that issue, and it might even have to hold a hearing. It might involve a motion in limine. But we never got to that issue because the district court really never addressed the issues we raised concerning the deficiencies in the audit.
So we're really not talking about tax law, we're not talking about the CBA.
No, to me it all comes down to the trust agreement, that they have to establish that they have the authority to collect and that there's a procedure a procedure set up by which they do so. And so we looked at what does the trust agreement says, And it says in cases when the trustees want to make a collection, they do an audit. And if they do an audit and find there's a deficiency, they can then sue and they can collect.
And so what would the audit done properly
show? Well, I think it would have been an audit done by an auditor consistent with generally acceptable accounting standards. And the auditor in this case, frankly, testified.
What would everything done correctly, what would it show?
I don't know, since one wasn't performed.
What's it going to show? You wanted to show that so much was done with construction and so much was done with builders, I guess. And then you want to subtract out whatever was done with construction.
Well, that would be the argument, but at this point the issue is no audit was performed, so we just overlook that error?
Well, we know there's some distinction, and it may not be half and half, it may be one-third and two-thirds, but that might not make any difference, unless you're saying categorically they cannot pay into the fund for residential.
Because they might time's up. Well, no.
Answer.
No. You know, I think it's a threshold issue on the whole audit. It's like we're talking past the audit, and let's discuss who's liable, what's employer liability, single employer issues. But until that initial issue is settled, what does an audit mean? Did they do it? If they didn't do an audit, they have no authority under the trust fund to file a lawsuit, to collect audit costs, to collect attorney fees. I don't think you can put the cart before the horse. I don't think we can say, well, you know, there's enough evidence in the record shows if they did an audit, you'd have been liable, so we're okay. But the trust funds don't say that. You know, we didn't draft it. We didn't draft the trust fund agreement, so we're bound by it. And it says they have to perform an audit, and if they do so, here's what they can collect and here's what they can do. There was no audit done, so I don't want to go, well, let's just assume there's an audit. How would you win? What's the liability issues?
It's a technical thing almost, because once the audit is done, whether it's 10-90 or 50-50, it's not going to make any difference.
Maybe. I mean, since in this case the auditor testified I didn't do an audit, so I can't offer any opinion about these documents, about the report, you know, the reports he created. If he did an audit, at least he'd have an opinion. Then maybe we could do our own audit, have our own expert have their own opinion. But in this case, we don't have any of that because no audit was done. It was agreed upon procedures, and under generally accepted accounting standards, according to this auditor, he could not offer any opinion about the contents of his report because it wasn't an audit.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to have to add, oh boy, a minute for Mr. Moody if he wants it.
A minute? May I please call?
No.
Oh, on the back side.
You're now getting 11 minutes.
Okay. May it please the court, my name is Jim Moody. I'm representing the plaintiffs in this case. And this is a routine payroll audit. I'll start out looking at page 23 of counsel's brief. And under one trust agreement, it says the trustees may, not shall, may have an audit made by an independent public accountant of payroll. Now, I am a CPA, actually, as well. If you do an audit in accordance with generally accepted auditing standards, you have to audit the entire company. You audit inventory, you audit accounts receivable, you audit revenues, you audit expenses. That these costs are shifted to the employer if there's a liability. So, you know, it'd be $10,000 to do an audit for all these companies. If I'm an employer, I have a contract with the laborers, the carpenters, the plumbers. If all those ERISA funds come in and do an audit of my entire financial statements, it would be ridiculous. That's why it says payroll here. They have limited scope procedures where they take the employer's books and records, they compare the payroll to the employees reported to the ERISA fund, and if there's a difference, they try to determine that difference based on time records and various employer records. According to ERISA, employers are supposed to maintain records that describes the type of work they perform. And
now,
here,
Mr. Olson argues that the union had separate collective bargaining agreements with each of his sole proprietorships, And what I'm wondering is, why would separate agreements be needed if this was a single employer?
Well, there's two district councils. One's Central Illinois Carpenters Health and Welfare Fund, and the other is Northern Illinois District Council. So they have agreements with Jay Olson. They don't have agreements with J&L Builders and J&L Construction. These two entities, that these union entities, they don't talk and work together on that basis. They don't look at the different employers who signatory. You can have somebody signatory to one but not the other, so they don't share the that information. The fact of the matter is, Jay Olson is the sole proprietor. He signed the agreement as J&L Builders. As J&L Construction at one point, he terminated that, and then 6 months later, he signed another agreement with the Central Illinois Carpenters, and that agreement covered residential carpenters and commercial carpenters. And there is no dispute. You don't even need the audit report. Jay Olson, in his deposition, admitted the various individuals who are, you know, carpenters. Conklin, employee Conklin, Dickerson, Harkin, Vespa, and Willis. He said, yes, they are all carpenters. And he also stated in his deposition that all J&L Construction does is framing of houses. That is essentially the same as what he did on the commercial side, except it was commercial buildings. There's just no dispute that these are carpenters. So what Judge Scott had to do is, number one, she knows there's residential carpenters. There's no doubt it's covered in the collective bargaining agreement. That's not even on appeal. So all she had to do was determine, is J&L Builders and J&L Construction a single employer? If they are, contributions are owed, because we know that residential carpenters are employed by J&L Construction. In fact, J&L Construction's whole argument was, we don't owe money because these are carpenters for J&L Construction. J&L Construction doesn't have an agreement with the union. It's J&L Builders. But if you put it together and you say they're a single employer, there's liability, period. The only question is, how much? And there were some minor discrepancies in the audit and sufficient enough for Judge Scott to say, okay, there's liability. I know what it is, but we have to have a trial on damages to determine the liability. And then they agreed to the damages. They agreed that this guy did carpenter's work, agreed to all the hours. And then they come back and dispute an audit report that we may do or we may not do. There are times when employers submit in contribution reporting forms and they don't submit the check, the money. So we have all these reporting forms for January, February, March, April, May, June, July, but we don't have any money. So we can't sue them because they haven't paid us? We have to go do an audit for 4 months or 6 months, and a full-blown audit at that? They would owe more in audit fees than they would in contributions.
We pay into this fund based on individual benefits, right?
Hours worked.
Or I should say retirement, whatever it is. So, but it's each individual, and that's the basis for it.
Correct.
That's how it's paid into the fund. I guess I don't understand this. There's only one fund, isn't there?
There's a pension fund and a health insurance fund.
One that you pay into, I mean. There's not two unions that have two different funds for different...
Well, there's been some mergers back and forth, but essentially there's a welfare fund and a pension fund. Like currently under the Central Illinois Carpenters, if you sign with them, you're paying into the pension and welfare
this
at one time.
This is what we're talking about?
Yes.
The combination?
Right.
Okay. And it's just, so is there one fund? So I mean, it may have two purposes, but there's one fund.
Well, there's a pension fund where someone will get a defined benefit, and then there's a welfare fund where you get your medical bills paid. Two separate entities.
Okay.
And the contributions are from employers based on hours worked by employees. and you know, they perform, these ERISA funds perform random payroll audits. There's an audit guide that I put in the brief that explains these agreed upon procedures. There was no agreed upon procedure to put everybody in the audit if you don't know whether they did covered work or not. That wasn't an agreement. If the records are so bad that they can't determine what work was covered, sometimes they put those individuals in the audit report and explain it in the audit report. Then it's up to the ERISA trustees to sort that out and figure out, you know, what did this person do? What did that person do? And sometimes it gets to a lawsuit, and you know, we take a deposition, we find out they're residential carpenters. But in this case, when Jay Olson, when the numbers showed up for J&L Construction in the audit report, Jay Olson, his whole defense was, yeah, they did carpenter work, but you know, they did it under my non-union residential, not my union commercial.
Well, there wasn't a non-union residential, was there?
Well, that's what J&L Construction is attempting to do, be a non-union residential builder. He's trying to have his cake and eat it too. When he wants to do commercial work where he's going to be seen on a job site and kicked off, you know, he wants to pretend like he's a union contractor, so he's got this, signs this agreement. When you're doing residential, you know, you can fly around and people don't really see, and it's easier to get away with it. But in this case, I mean, he's a sole proprietor for both companies. He filed one tax return that covers all the business operations. He has the same employees for J&L Builders, J&L Construction. At the end of the year, he pays them one W-2. He has one FEIN number that he reports to the IRS.
Do they get paid the same for each job?
I don't know.
You don't know
that? I don't know.
Would it make a difference if you had to pay benefits?
No. It's based on hours worked. So if you work 10 hours, whatever the contribution rate is, times 10 hours, that's what goes into the fund.
No, I don't mean it goes into the fund. I'm sorry, somebody to take home pay.
No, it doesn't affect. Well, the employer pays the contributions. It doesn't come off the man's
100%
check.
Of it.
Yeah.
So, okay.
You know, if you look at the other trust agreement, just to follow up on that, it says on page 24 of counsel's brief, says, in the event upon audit made by the trustees or other evidence it's found that the employer failed to make the required contributions, you know, we can pursue those. But that's in the event of an audit. There's no we must audit and it must be full blown. That's just... If the court ruled in that way, if this court did, the burden on employers to pay $5,000-$10,000 multiplied by five or six unions to do an audit to verify that you paid your contributions, it would be very onerous on the employers of this circuit. That's all I have.
You know, but would you give him 2 minutes, please?
I just want to briefly clear up the confusion, a little bit of confusion on the, there's actually three trust funds, and in the one there is the language that the judge quoted concerning payroll, but the other three just say, in the event upon an audit. And then they say the trustees then can do the following. So it's not just a throwaway line that, no, you don't have to do an audit, you can do what you want. It's a very specific procedure that's put forth there. I know I only have a little time, so as I was preparing for this last night, I was thinking we're going to argue about single employer, we're going to argue about audit, and we're having these very factual intensive arguments here in the appellate court because the district court simply never addressed the arguments we raised below. And I think whatever justice means to anyone, it has to encompass the fact that somebody is heard. In this case, our clients simply were never heard. The district court denied our motion for summary judgment, finding, oh, there's a material dispute as to damages. We never argued that. We argued that we were entitled to summary judgment on the issue of liability. In opposing the fund's motion for summary judgment, we argued the trust agreements say an audit has to be done. No audit was done. The district court did not address that. In fact, there's no mention of the trust agreement language in the district court opinion or in opposing counsel's brief. That's really all I had, unless there's a specific question.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.